Hello, beautiful people. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your guest host. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I am coming to you from a world that does not have to be this way. We're going to begin today's show with a segment on exploitation, what it is, and how to put an end to it. This is a piece that was written by Bob Avakian, the revolutionary leader and author of The New Communism, and it's narrated by a member of the RNL, the Revolution Nothing Less Show team. We're going to follow that substantive, meaty piece that gets to the essence of the world we live in and why and how it could be radically changed. We're going to follow that with the very first question that I had the incredible honor and fortune of putting to Bob Avakian in the interviews that Andy Z and I did with him on the Revolution Nothing Less show called Up Close and Personal with Bob Avakian, Heart and Soul and Hardcore for Revolution. And I have to say, if you do not want to live in a world the way it is today, if you are sick and tired of so many people being treated as less than human, if you're sick of the promises and the empty promises and the broken promises and the lies year after year after year from politicians and those trying to make this system so-called work always failing, it is both uplifting and challenging to connect with Bob Avakian, the leader of the revolution, the author of The New Communism, and someone who has, on a scientific foundation, come to understand thoroughly, that this system cannot be reformed to become anything that would ever meet the interests of the masses of people, not only in this country, but around the world, this system of capitalism and imperialism, but that it can be overthrown and something far better can be brought about through a real revolution. And Bob Avakian has not only charted the course to make that revolution, not only re-envisioned the framework for human emancipation, he is someone who, as a person, who has dedicated his life for over 50 years to the cause of human emancipation and never lost his sense of humor, his heart and his love for humanity, and his bone-deep determination to make a revolution that can put this system in its grave and bring about a new epoch for all of humanity where we can finally get free. So we're going to play you the opening of the interview that I did with him. It is a chance to get to know him and his own development and how he came to be who he is today, or at least a sense of that. After that, we are going to share a little segment of Rafael Cadaris out on the road in New York City at Revolution Books up in Harlem, speaking on woke lunacy versus real revolution. And this is a tour that he and I have been doing, a tour and campaign out here where I'm based in California. We started, but we're taking it nationwide, and we're going to play a portion of the Q&A where he gets into a deep question posed by a member of the audience on the nature of objective reality, individual experience, empathy, and getting to the root of the oppression that humanity faces so that we can get humanity free. It's a really great excerpt. I'll have some words to say about it when we get to that. And then finally, at the back end of the show, I'm going to bring a report on the anti-LGBTQ fascist so-called parents' rights rally that happened last week in Los Angeles, which is a microcosm of what's happening at school boards across the country and part of the deep divides that go all the way to the top and all the way down to the masses of people throughout society where this country is splitting apart. And this parents' right rally in Los Angeles could also be called a joint fascist and LAPD rally, because the Los Angeles Police Department came out and assaulted those who were standing up to the fascists and defending the school board and defending LGBTQ rights days after Lori Carlton was murdered in cold blood for displaying a rainbow flag outside her small business just a little ways away in another part of California. So in this context, members of the LA Revolution Club and others stood up to these fascists. The LA Revolution Club members did this as part of organizing people to prepare for revolution, to defend the rights and the lives of the people under attack while building up the organized strength to make a revolution. And the counter-protesters, the anti-fascist protesters, the Revolution Club and others, were assaulted by the LAPD. That's why I call it a joint fascist and LAPD rally. They were assaulted, brutalized, brutally assaulted, and at least one of the members of the LA Revolution Club was arrested. So we will hear Noche Diaz, who is the national spokesperson for the Revolution Club, speak about the anti-LGBTQ rally in LA and the need for a real revolution. So we've got a great show. It's packed. We got getting into this from different angles. And with that, let's dive in. Let's get started with exploitation, what it is, and how to put an end to it.
Exploitation. What it is, how to put an end to it, by Bob Avakian. In a recent report about revolutionary work in Chicago, one of the people there drawn to the revolution indicated that he did not know what the word exploitation means, because this word exploitation describes something very basic about the system of capitalism that we are now forced to live under, and because many people do not have a clear understanding of this, it is important to explain what is meant by exploitation. In the most general sense, to exploit means to take advantage. More specifically, it can mean taking advantage of, using other people. And in terms of a scientific understanding with regard to the economy, exploitation refers to a situation where one person or a group of people accumulates capitalist wealth that is created by the labor of others. Capitalism is a system in which a relatively small number of people, the capitalists, own and control the major means of production: factories, land, raw materials, machinery and other technology, and so on, and are therefore in a position to force other people who do not own or control means of production to work for them. It is the labor of those exploited by the capitalists, and not the brilliance or entrepreneurial genius of the capitalists, that actually creates the wealth that the capitalists appropriate, take for their own profit and use. Once again, the capitalists are in a position to appropriate wealth that is produced by others whom they exploit, because the capitalists own and control the major means of production. Means of production which themselves were created through the labor of people exploited by capitalists. For example, in a capitalist-owned factory, the machinery that people work on was produced by people in other factories working on raw materials to create that machinery. And those raw materials, in turn, were mined by people also working under conditions of capitalist exploitation. Under the capitalist system, there is always a surplus population, people who are unemployed because they cannot be profitably exploited. And the existence of people in this position is something which the capitalists take advantage of in exploiting those they do employ. If you don't want this job at the wage I'm paying you, there are plenty of other people out there who are desperate for work. Today, this system of capitalism has developed into a highly globalized system of exploitation, capitalism imperialism, in which a relatively small number of capitalists own and control means of production on a massive scale and appropriate huge amounts of capitalist wealth on the basis of exploiting billions of people throughout the world, including hundreds of millions of women and more than 150 million children, who are most viciously exploited, super exploited, especially in the third world, Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Once again, these billions of people are in a position where they can be viciously exploited because they do not own means of production. Many of them, particularly in third world countries, are people whose families previously owned small parcels of land on which they farmed. But they have been forced off the land, no longer able to survive by farming.
This is a tremendous problem because according to the UN, about 735 million people faced hunger last year. Now that breaks down to nearly 10% of the world's population. And these numbers are even higher when you factor in those who lack adequate or healthy food. That number accounts for nearly 30% of humanity.
In large part because of the domination of the politics and the economy of their countries by capitalists centered in imperialist countries like the US. It is this system of capitalism-imperialism that is the root cause of all of the horrendous, unnecessary suffering and madness that people throughout the world are subjected to. And the growing threat to the very existence of human beings as a whole. To get rid of exploitation and all the oppression that goes along with it, it is necessary to get rid of the system of capitalism-imperialism. And that means making revolution to overthrow this system and replacing it with a fundamentally different and far better system based on the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. What this revolution and this radically new system are all about, why this revolution is possible, and how to carry out this revolution. All this is made clear in a number of works of mine and others at revcom.us, including the proclamation, We Are the RevComs, and the declaration from the RevComs, We need and we demand a whole new way to live, a fundamentally different system, as well as the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. This is also brought alive on the YouTube RNL Revolution Nothing Less show. And here's the challenge. Everyone who can't stand this world the way it is, who is sick and tired of so many people being treated as less than human, who knows that the claim of liberty and justice for all is a cruel lie. Who is righteously enraged that injustice and inequality go on and on and on, despite false promises and honeyed words from people in power or those seeking power. Everyone who agonizes about where things are headed and the fact that to be young now means being denied a decent future or any future at all. Everyone who has ever dreamed about something much better or even wondered whether that is possible. Everyone who hungers for a world without oppression, exploitation, poverty, and destruction of the environment. Everyone who has the heart to fight for something that is really worth fighting for. You need to be part of this revolution. Especially at a time like this, a time when big things are up in the world, affecting the whole future of humanity, when those big-time exploiters and oppressors who rule over us in this country are bitterly divided among themselves and increasingly unable to hold things together as a unified ruling class. When there is not just an urgent need, but a real possibility to seize on this situation to overthrow them altogether. If you are not getting with the RevComs, revolutionary communists who are working every day for this revolution. If you are not part of working to bring about this revolution, then what the hell are you doing? Bob Avakian included three substantive footnotes throughout this article, which deepen our understanding of materialism. Footnote number one, on the bitter effects of exploitation. The bitter effects of being part of the exploited class, the proletariat, under the capitalist system is something people experience in their everyday life. In the book, The New Communism, I spoke to this. Quote, you may be at the bottom of society. Either you have no job and you're scuffling the way you can, or you get a job and somebody exploits you. And to get that job, you have to go and sell yourself. That's what you do. You go in for a job interview and they say, well, now let's get into your history and all that. Sometimes they want you to piss in a bottle, and sometimes they want to know everything about your personal history. They want to know if you've ever been arrested, or do you have a felony conviction.
So you left college before you finished?
Yes.
Why?
I got a felony conviction.
And you can't say, what the f***? Just give me the job, goddammit, I'm hungry. You're out the door. You can't even more politely say, excuse me, but that's kind of a personal question, don't you think? No, because the person interviewing you is working for the people who own the means of production, and you don't own any. So you're in a powerless position, because if you don't satisfy them, they don't hire you. As for the foundation of the capitalist system, this was built up with a lot of violence. For example, in Europe, several centuries ago, large numbers of peasants, small-scale farmers, were driven off their land and forced into the position of proletarians, having to sell their labor power, their ability to work, to capitalists developing in the cities on the basis of their role as merchants, as the heads of early manufacturing associations, as moneylenders. In the Americas, huge numbers of the original inhabitants, who had managed to survive the wars and disease brought by European invaders, were forced to labor, often under literally life-stealing conditions, to enrich exploiters who came to the Americas from Spain and other countries. And let us not forget, the foundation for the wealth of this capitalist country, the good old USA, was to a very large extent based on slave labor. As Karl Marx, the founder of communism, pointed out, with biting irony, the rosy dawn of capitalism was marked by the enslavement of massive numbers of Africans. Literally working to death, conquered people in South America, forced to mine precious metals, and other monstrous means of accumulating wealth. It is a fact that some of the earlier societies in the Americas, such as the Inca Empire in South America and the Aztecs in Mexico, were themselves based on exploitation of masses of people by the ruling classes in those societies. And it is true that there was slavery within Africa itself for some time before the invasion of that continent by European exploiters. But all this took on much greater and more horrific dimensions beginning several centuries ago with the conquest and colonization of these continents. The development of the international slave trade and the relentless machinery of capitalist exploitation. Capitalist exploitation, through which generation after generation of people, in the millions and millions, have been ruthlessly used up and killed off, quickly or more slowly, in the manic capitalist quest and merciless competition among capitalists for profit and more profit.
There has been another horrific incident at a garment factory in Bangladesh.
Over 1,000 people died when an illegally extended 8-story building, which was a garment factory, collapsed in an instant. They made clothes mainly for Western fashion brands.
I was hearing the scream from the rubble, someone saying, chop off my leg and pull me out.
Footnote number 2, on the other capitalist exploiters. besides those who are directly involved in exploiting people in the process of producing the wealth of the capitalist system, there are also other capitalist exploiters. For example, there are the banks and other financial institutions that make profit through loans to the corporations and other businesses that directly exploit people. These loans have to be repaid with an additional amount of money, the interest. Plus, often these financial institutions themselves invest in the corporations that are directly exploiting people. And in turn, large-scale corporations also become involved in financial transactions. Finance capital becomes woven together with capital directly used to exploit people in the process of production. There are also merchant capitalists, for example, those who sell clothing or food and other basic necessities. And then there are those who invest in the stock market. But that just amounts to a kind of gambling, betting on which capitalist enterprises will be more successful in exploiting people. Here is the most fundamental point. The source of the wealth that these different capitalists accumulate is the exploitation of people who are forced to work for one or another capitalist or capitalist corporation in the process of producing the things that people use. Footnote number 3, on why this is a time when revolution could be made. Why this is a rare time when revolution, even in a powerful imperialist country like the U.S., becomes more possible, is examined in a number of works of mine and others at revcom.us, including Revolution, Major Turning Points and Rare Opportunities, as well as Something Terrible or Something Truly Emancipating, Profound Crises, Deepening Divisions, The Looming Possibility of Civil War, and The Revolution That is Urgently Needed, A Necessary Foundation, A Basic Roadmap for This Revolution, and Organizing for an Actual Revolution, 7 Key Points. And again, this is also brought alive on the YouTube RNL Revolution Nothing Less Show. We want to go back to the conclusion of Babovican's article, Exploitation, What It Is, How to Put an End to It. B.A. writes, quote, "Everyone who can't stand this world the way it is, who is sick and tired of so many people being treated as less than human, who knows that the claim of liberty and justice for all is a cruel lie, who is righteously enraged that injustice and inequality go on and on and on. Despite false promises and honeyed words from people in power or those seeking power, everyone who agonizes about where things are headed and the fact that to be young now means being denied a decent future or any future at all, everyone who has ever dreamed about something much better or even wonder whether that is possible, everyone who hungers for a world without oppression, exploitation, poverty, and destruction of the environment, everyone who has the heart to fight for something that is really worth fighting for, you need to be part of this revolution. Especially at a time like this, a time when big things are up in the world, affecting the whole future of humanity, when those big-time exploiters and oppressors who rule over us in this country are bitterly divided among themselves and increasingly unable to hold things together as a unified ruling class. When there is not just an urgent need, but a real possibility to seize on this situation to overthrow them altogether. If you are not getting with the RevComs, revolutionary communists, who are working every day for this revolution, if you are not part of working to bring about this revolution, then what the hell are you doing?
That was Exploitation, What It Is, and How to Put an End to It. It was written by Bob Avakian and narrated by a member of the RNL, the Revolution Nothing Less team. And I want to urge you to go and watch the illustrated version, the video version of that same article, which is available at youtube.com/therevcoms on the channel of the Revolution Nothing Less show. It is beautifully illustrated. This should be shown in classrooms. It should be taught in classes. It should be discussed, get groups of friends together. This gets the essence of why we live in such a grossly divided society and world, with whole swaths of humanity cast off toiling in sweatshops and fields and mind-numbing, brain-draining, back-breaking jobs that go nowhere, while a sliver of humanity lives fattened by this. And how we get beyond that, it's really profound. And let me remind you, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. My name is Sansara Taylor. I am your guest host. And now we want to move to Up Close and Personal with Bob Avakian, Heart and Soul, and Hardcore for Revolution. So the first question we wanted to ask you takes off from a spoken word piece that you wrote a number of years ago, an incredible spoken word piece called All Played Out. And I want to read the second verse and ask you about it. You write, "This puffed up stuff about the land of the free."
This puffed up stuff about the land of the free and the home of the brave. A country that built itself on bodies of slaves and ruthless genocidal robbery. That spreads its empire through plunder, driving countless people under. With its bloody red, white, and blue rag unfurled. All this pompous nonsense about the leader of the free world. That's all laid out.
A country that built itself on bodies of slaves and ruthless genocidal robbery, that spreads its empire through plunder, driving countless people under with its bloody red, white, and blue rag unfurled. All this pompous nonsense about the leader of the free world, that's all played out. So we wanted to ask and give you a chance to talk about, did you always have this view of America? And if not, how did you first come to see this country in this way and its role in the world?
Oh no. I was a very loyal American. You know, I think I said in my memoir that one time I said I felt like getting down on my knees and thanking God that I was born in this great country, unlike all these other unfortunate people all around the world who were, forced to live in other countries. And I remember when I was 16, I think, I went to a Giants baseball game in San Francisco. And of course they play the national anthem before. And so, you know, everybody rose and I got up and I enthusiastically was singing, you know, "Oh, say can you see," et cetera, et cetera. And when it finished, the woman in front of me turned around and said, "My, you have a beautiful voice." And I just can't help thinking back about the irony of that, you know. But then as I did learn things, I used to go to the games and this was during the Vietnam War when they would play the national anthem. I did a different version that someone I knew was part of the movement that I was part of made up, which was, "Oh, Uncle Sam, get out of Vietnam. Get out of Vietnam." So that was a different rendition of the song and didn't get quite the same response from the people in front of me, but you know, that was a transformation I went through. And it was a lot of different things. I grew up in Berkeley. I was very fortunate to go to a high school. There was only one high school in the entire city, so everybody, of course, went to it. And in those days, there weren't all these Christian fundamentalist schools. There were a few Catholic schools, but mostly everybody went to the high school, the public high school. And so you were thrown together with all these people, you know, Latinos, you know, there were a lot of black people, and, you know, some of whom I had known from being in sports competition earlier. And then we got put together, and because I was playing football, I was in gym class with a lot of people who were on the football team who had come from the different middle schools or junior high schools where they were mainly black people. And so this was like introduced me to a whole different side of America. And, you know, I had a lot of experiences. Some of them are funny to look back on, but they weren't particularly funny at the time. You know, they were kind of hair-raising. But, you know, this was starting me on a different path of learning about what this country is really all about. So that was the start of it.
I have to ask, funny and hair-raising. Maybe you could give an example.
Well, you know, when I was in 10th grade, this high school was only 3 years at that time, 10th grade, 11th, and 12th. So when I was in 10th grade, I was in gym class, and at that particular time, our instruction, so to speak, was swimming. And so I was, you know, just standing by the pool, hanging out, and there was this friend of mine, Langston Tabor, who, you know, had come from a different junior high, but then we had some friction when we played sports in junior high, but then we became friends in high school, and he was kind of hanging out behind me, and I'm just minding my own business, and all of a sudden this big dude comes up and he's just looming over me, and he looks at me and he says, "Are you Bob Avakian?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Did you go to Garfield?" That's the junior high I went to, which was almost all white. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Did you play basketball?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you play against Burbank?" That's where he went. I said, "Yeah." And I'm trying to figure out what the hell's going on here. And he said, "Did you foul me?" And then I had a sense something big was up, you know. And so, but you know, I was kind of naive, so I just kind of straightforwardly said, "Well, I might have. I can't remember something like that." And then he looked at me, and he got this big grin across his face. And I thought it might have lasted like a minute or two, probably only lasted about 15 seconds. And then he finally just kind of turned and slowly walked away. And after this was over, Langston came running up to me, and he said, "Man, you don't know what just happened here." He said, "That's Jack McRae. He's one of the baddest dudes in the whole school." And I said, "What are you talking about, man?" He said, "You know," he said, "he was getting ready to fire on you. He was going to punch you out." I said, "Come on, man." He was smiling. And he laughed and he said, "Yeah, but when he gets that smile on his face, that's when he's going to unload on somebody." But I guess what happened was Jack just kind of looked at it and said, "Oh, man, this white boy, he just kind of doesn't get it. So I'm just going to let him slide." So that was kind of a, you know, a thing that made an impression on me, shall we say. You know, it started me thinking about a bunch of stuff, because you realized that this wasn't really just about, you know, the basketball game. There was a lot of tension in that game. In fact, they nearly stopped the game because we had broke out, fights were just about ready to break out every few minutes. But this was much more like people testing you, you know, like, see where are you coming from? What kind of person are you? You know, how are you going to respond when they put it to you a little bit? You know, because there's things were going on that were much bigger than me and Jack McRae. This was the whole time when the civil rights movement was gaining momentum, and it also translated into personal relations and just, you know, everyday social relations where, you know, people, especially black people, just weren't putting up with the way they had before, you know, and they were feeling the strength of the, you know, gathering movement. And so this was sort of an expression of that, even though it was in a sort of a personal realm. And so, you know, these are the kind of experiences that I had a number of times in high school that kind of, you know, opened me up to more things, should I say.
The other thing that you cited and you sang was "Get Out of Vietnam."
Yeah.
How did that play into your changing view on America?
Well, you see, here's where things are interconnected. Like, as a result of these experiences, I made a lot of friends of different kinds. You know, I ate lunch one semester with some Japanese girls who were, you know, very sharp and smart, but also, you know, a lot of fun. So I learned something about their culture, you know. And then, you know, just going through high school and everything, I really began, as a result of black friends of mine, you know, to get a much better, deeper sense of what it was like to be black in this country and the whole history of it. I mean, you know, not that they gave me history lessons, but just, you know, the everyday exchanges of friends, you know. I began, and I really developed a deep anger and hatred about this. And I remember the turning point for me about Vietnam came in the 1965, when there was a march, you know, from Selma. And I got up in the morning and I got the newspaper and I opened up this big article about this attack on these civil rights marchers, you know, on the Pettus Bridge. And I was going back and forth about Vietnam. I'd been part of the free speech movement in Berkeley, and most of the leaders, if not all of them, of that movement were against the Vietnam War. But I hadn't made up my mind yet. I was very, I respected them a lot. I was influenced by them, but I hadn't really, I was doing some study to try to understand it, but I hadn't made up my mind. And I opened up the paper that day, and I looked at it, and these pictures of Selma, and I said to myself, how in the f- can the rulers of this country be trying to bring freedom to the people in Vietnam when this is what goes on in this country, time after time? And, you know, yes, it's in the South, but the leaders of the country as a whole are doing nothing to stop this. How in the hell can they be bringing freedom to the people in Vietnam? And that was it for me. From then on, I was firmly opposed to the Vietnam War.
That was a question from Up Close and Personal with Bob Avakian, the revolutionary leader, the author of The New Communism, Heart and Soul and Hardcore for Revolution. This series of three interviews conducted by Andy Z and myself as part of the RNL, the Revolution Nothing Less show, is just an unparalleled experience. It is impossible to quantify how important these interviews are at this moment in history where the future of humanity hangs in the balance. And Bob Avakian is a leader like no other on this planet. He's not like the lying politicians who promise you this or that reform that never, ever, ever comes through in a way that meets the needs of humanity while the planet burns and this system hurdles us closer towards nuclear confrontation with China or Russia, the U.S. imperialist gangsters, rival imperialists. And while fascism rises in this country and these politicians promise, oh, we'll make these changes or those changes or those changes, and it doesn't measure up because the system can't be reformed. Bob Avakian roots himself in the reality, the scientifically determined reality that this system cannot be reformed, but it can be and it must be overthrown. And we are in a rare time when this revolution is more possible than it's been in generations. It's not apparent on the surface. Things are headed towards something far more dangerous, even than we've lived through thus far. But it is also more possible to wrench it in a different direction. Bob Avakian applies science, penetrating science, in these interviews to reveal why that is so and how we move on it and why it's worth it and why people need to change what they're doing with their lives. Enough with this me, 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 and chasing money, 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 and into patriarchy and all kinds of other things, getting over on others. It's time to think about humanity first, and Bob Avakian is, I mean, he just, he brings you into how he approaches this, and he takes you and opens up your eyes to what is possible. It is an extraordinary journey. All three sections are available at revcom.us or the YouTube channel, youtube.com/therevcoms. That was just the first question in the interview. So finally, oh, not finally, but next, we have two more sections left. Next, we're going to talk about woke lunacy versus real revolution, beginning with a few words I shared about this on the Revolution Nothing Less show, followed by part of a Q&A with Rafael Cadaris.
We turn now to the national speaking tour and campaign that I have been spearheading, along with Rafael Cadaris, a regular contributor to this show, called Woke Lunacy versus Real Revolution. Now, why are we doing this campaign? Well, Rafael broke this down well in the speech that he gave last week at Revolution Books up in Harlem, New York City. He brought alive the intensifying climate destruction that we are facing, having just lived through the hottest month recorded in 120,000 years, as well as the growing threat of nuclear war between the U.S. gangster imperialists and their rivals in Russia and China. And he dug into the rise of fascism in this country, and how none of this can be solved under this system. What is urgently needed, and right now what is more possible, is a real revolution and a whole new system and a whole new way to live as envisioned in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. Yet, right now, at this very moment, as Rafael got into it.
And right now, one of the biggest roadblocks especially for young people who need to be a key part of this revolution, is woke identity politics. Think about everything I described about the moment we're living in. College campuses should be hotbeds of resistance and revolution. Students should be looking at the big picture, seeking out and debating root causes and real solutions. Instead, wokeness is shutting down questioning, lowering people's sights, and misdirecting their outrage in destructive ways, furthering the nightmare we face, a narcissistic obsession with self and identity, a focus on changing words rather than changing the world, and hiding from reality with safe spaces and trigger warnings, a cannibalistic cancel culture backed up by identity politics police dictating who has a right to speak and make art. And if you haven't experienced something directly, you should just shut up and stay in your lane, check your privilege. All aimed at getting a seat at the table in this blood-soaked American empire.
And then through the course of his presentation, Raphael went deeply into the philosophical underpinnings of this woke identity politics. He went into its political bankruptcy and its anti-revolutionary program. And he brought alive how we need to be casting this off and struggling with others to cast it off and working now for a real revolution that can emancipate all of humanity. So we want to urge you to go and watch the full speech and Q&A that followed, which you can find at revcom.us or at revolutionbooksnyc.org. And even more, to go to revcom.us and find the extensive work that Bob Avakian has done on this question, which Raphael and I are basing ourselves on in taking up this tour and campaign. But today, on today's episode, we want to share a portion of the Q&A from the event that he did in New York City that touches on a crucial question about what is the nature of truth and how do we come to know it? Let's watch.
I see one in the back and then we'll come to you in the front.
I agree that, you know, the cancel culture is very toxic. And I think that as far as, you know, yes, there is one objective reality, but, you know, each individual person experiences that reality very differently, which I think can impeach someone's ability to understand certain things. And I think that the further removed you are from certain types of oppression in those situations, the harder it is for some people to really empathize and actually understand what those oppressed communities are going through. And so in that way, we're living different truths.
When you're talking about bridge the gap, you're talking about like people with more privilege who may not understand certain things or may not have experienced certain things. Okay, first of all, this is a good question. I just want to step back to what is truth, because you went from people have different experiences, which is true. We people do have all kind of, you know, they do have different experiences. Like when I am in front of a cop and I stick my hands in my pockets, I don't have to worry the same way as a black person does about getting murdered, you know, being seen as a threat in the same way, right? And, you know, I gave the example about what women have to go through just going for a jog in this society, you know, and I don't have to deal with that, right? But, but then you went from that, the fact that people have different experiences, to saying different truths. But truth just means, truth is a correct correspondence with reality. That's all truth means. It means it corresponds to reality. And, you know, experiences are part of reality, but that's something anyone can come to understand. That's why it is actually important for people to, you know, hear the stories and learn the experiences of other people. I mean, how do we bridge that gap? It means people have to learn what other people go through. It's, you know, people should actually learn about the migrants right now who are crossing the Darien Gap in Panama through the jungles, basically trying to, you know, get to the north, right? And, you know, they're on foot going through horrendous situations. People are dying along the way. They're having to leave all their in the jungle, in the mud, because they can't carry it all. Little babies are going through this. They're getting sick. Some of them are dying. This is the people have to learn about this. But then, you know, and it is part of coming to empathize with other people. I think that's really important. We have to get out of a situation where people are just concerned about themselves and they're just concerned about their identity group. You know, they have to, and especially for people in America, they have to start thinking about, you know, not just about Americans, but the people of the world. That's very important. But why are people having to go on that journey from the Darien Gap? You know, why are so many of them Venezuelan? What's going on in Venezuela? Do you know about the sanctions that the U.S. has put on the country of Venezuela, knowing that it's going to cause malnutrition for, like, millions of little children in that country, forcing parents to have to flee? You know, this is the kind of thing that actually, it doesn't just come from experience. It comes from, like, actually an analysis of the situation. This is what, and this is the essential thing. If, you know, if you're just trying to empathize with other people, well, you should just learn their experiences. But if you actually want to stop this, you have to learn what's the system behind it. You know, you have to actually dig down to the roots of it. You know, our friend over here mentioned intersectionality, all right? I think she talked about intersections, right, and different axes of oppression. And, you know, intersectionality analyzes there's, you know, racism, there's gender oppression, there's oppression based on sexuality. There's all these different axes of oppression. But what it doesn't get to is what's the actual underlying system that all this oppression is rooted in. It's a global system of capitalism, imperialism, you know, and this is actually, how do you bridge that gap? You have to dig down to the roots of that system, because not only is there a problem with people not understanding each other's experiences, but as long as you have this capitalist imperialist system in place, different groups will be pitted against each other. Different identity groups. And some of that will be the conscious manipulation of the powers that be, the way that they consciously pit different groups against each other. You know, but some of it is just everyone, you know, under capitalism, you just got to pursue your self-interest. You know, people may know about, there was Cherokee Indians, Native Americans who were Cherokee, who owned slaves. And there were black people, Buffalo Soldiers, celebrated in the Bob Marley song, that went out west to slaughter Native Americans. You know, so this is how the system pits different oppressed groups against each other. It, you know, so we got to get to the root of that system.
Now, that was just a taste of the very rich program with Rafael Cadaris at Revolution Books in New York City called Woke Lunacy versus Real Revolution. And again, we urge you to watch the full program at revolutionbooksnyc.org or at revcom.us, and reach out to us wherever you are to connect with this tour, to bring us to speak on your campus or in your town, and to get involved in other ways.
This is The Michael Slate Show. My name is Sansara Taylor, and we've been listening to a question and response with Rafael Cadaris from the Woke Lunacy versus Real Revolution Tour, which Rafael and myself are taking to colleges and communities across this country. You can learn more about the tour. You can find hours of video from different presentations, Q&A, and engagement at revcom.us. And you can reach out to us to bring this tour where you are, or connect with it to pose your own question to get involved. Now, for the final part of the show, on August 22nd, a so-called parents' rights group attacked a meeting of the LA Unified School District in downtown Los Angeles. These are Nazi stormtroopers. They're spreading hatred of LGBTQ people. They are fighting to suppress the history of the enslavement, the brutality and white supremacy that is built into this country and in this system. And they're fighting for a whole host of other fascist measures as part of the fascist attempt to remake U.S. society. And in this rally, they were backed up by the LAPD, and they were met by a determined counter-protest, determined but far too small, of decent people, including members of the LA Revolution Club. And the police set upon these counter-protesters, savagely brutalized and beat them and arrested them. So we're going to hear a report from the protest and a message from Noche Diaz, who is the national spokesperson for the Revolution Club.
As Andy mentioned at the opening of today's show, this country is sharply divided from the very top all the way down to the local school boards across this country. And this is true here in Los Angeles as much as anywhere. This past week, a march of about 150 fascists marched on the central LA school district school board meeting with a whole lot of anti-trans, anti-truthful history of this country and its white supremacy, a whole lot of fascist demands.
What brings you out here? What are they doing with the children?
Molesting them, basically. That's all they're doing.
Who is they when you talk about they?
The LGBT community. They're all child molesters, all of them.
You're trying to turn our kids gay, it's not right.
They're teaching the kids all the bad, they're grooming the kids, and I just want them to teach something good. The goodness of the Lord. Teach the Bible.
Fortunately, here in L.A., they were counter-protested. Unfortunately, by a much smaller crowd, about 50 people came out and counter-protested them, including members of the Revolution Club here in Los Angeles. The police were out, unjustly, brutally attacked the counter-protesters, including assaulting and arresting a member of the Revolution Club here. We're very happy to report that she has been released and she is in very good spirits. What we want to do now is give you just a snippet of the local news coverage and then share with you a TikTok that the Revolution Club put together.
Downtown LA, where dueling rallies are facing off, LGBTQ groups are countering parents' rights protesters in a heated exchange over school curriculum.
We are here opposing this fascist white supremacist bigot right across from us, who are fighting on a national level to openly discriminate against LGBT people.
I need to talk to you, who saw that yesterday, even here in liberal LA, there was a regional gathering of fascists who have been part of attacking these LGBT rights and lives, and a police assault on those who are opposing those fascists. When they say parents' rights, they are talking about the right to terrorize trans and LGBT kids. They see themselves as part of a new confederacy, and they have been preparing for a one-sided civil war against everyone they hate. And the way that this country has been held together, as terrible as it has been, cannot continue to hold it together. You need to become part of working with the RevCons now to wake people up to the potential for something truly terrible, even worse than what has already been a system of oppression and exploitation. You need to be working with the RevCons now to wake people up to what needs to and can be done about this, of letting people know that there is a force, a strategy, and a program and leadership for a real revolution, a whole better way to live in a fundamentally different system.
That was Noche Diaz, the national spokesperson for the revolution clubs across the country, on the fascist rally and counter demonstration in downtown Los Angeles last week and the need for revolution. And that brings us to the end of another show. This has been the Michael Slate Show, the one and only Michael Slate Show. We want to close out the show by sending our love, as always, to Michael Slate. And thank you for tuning in. I want to give my thanks as well to Henry Carson, our assistant producer. My name is Sansara Taylor. I am your guest host. I will be back with you next week. And until then, remember, the problem is not human nature. It is the nature of the system. Through a real revolution, a better world is possible. I'll talk to you next week. We very sadly marked the passing of Sinead O'Connor. And we still love her and miss her and treasure the art that she left us and the courage and the acting on conscience. So I would like to go out this week with one more of her pieces, a collaboration she did with the Chieftains called The Foggy Dew.
Squadrons pass me by. outside in the springing of the year. While the world did gaze with deep amaze at those fearless men, but few who bore their fight, that freedom's light might shine through the foggy dew. So